Welcome to the Tennis with an Accent podcast. This is your co-host, Matt Zemek, along with Saqib Ali. This is not a bite-sized podcast. We hope you enjoyed our 20 to 25-minute shows over the fortnight. We did several of them, but this is a regular full enchilada podcast. Now that the Australian Open is over, Novak Djokovic and Naomi Osaka are your singles champions. And to make sense of not just the finals themselves, but also the tournament, and then to pivot a little bit to 2021 and how this first major has reset our expectations for the year ahead, we're going to tackle all those topics. We bring back our in-house analyst, Mert Ertunga, on Twitter, Murtov's the letter T desk, Murtov's T desk. He writes at Murtov's Tennis Desk, his website, and he contributes to Tennis with an Accent. Mert, welcome back to the Tennis with an Accent podcast.
Delighted to be here with the two of you. Thank you, Matt.
Saqib, first before asking Mert, Saqib, you weren't feeling well earlier in the week. Any thoughts that you have on this Australian Open as we get into our conversation with Mert?
Thanks for asking. I sorry to bail out in the last two podcasts due to work, and then I was feeling terrible. I was feeling sick that day. So that was my Sampras-like moment. I turned the audio on for you guys, and, after that, all hell broke loose. Sampras Kerecha comes to mind. But this tournament, again, in the Big Three era, and if you also talk about the onset of the Naomi Osaka era, I think there's a lot to unpack. And with the solid support cast of other contenders and favorites, and still the legends are going on. So I think my questions and my thoughts will be aligned with what you have in mind. It's an eventful tournament, quite an uneventful end if you were looking for close matches, but it's also a testimony to how good Novak Djokovic can be on this court. And not that we take him for granted, but I was one of the small minority, or maybe a big minority, who thought Medvedev not doesn't have a chance, but he will win it. And again, Djokovic and Nadal, you learn these lessons, at end of most fortnights. So I'll give you the floor to fire away your first question as I continue to organize my thoughts and feed some questions along with you to Mert, who's been on fire, who's just coming off a Turkish podcast. I mean, this guy is just, he's the real deal here.
He is the real deal. And of course, we want to remind our audience that Mert had Brady and Muhova in the top half women's semifinal. He correctly predicted all four women's semifinalists. So we're always going to remind our audience of that. Mert had a great tournament in terms of forecasting it. But for the men, and particularly the final between Novak Djokovic and Daniil Medvedev, I think most people were probably expecting Djokovic to win because he did say that he was pain-free after the semifinal against Karatsev. I mean, that right there seemed to restore Djokovic's position compared to the middle matches in the tournament when he was clearly in pain against Raonic and also Zverev. So I do think people were generally expecting Djokovic to win, but I don't think many people were expecting the match to be as straightforward as it was, with Djokovic dominating in the second and third sets after a very close first set. So, Mert, just your overall impressions on this men's final.
Top-notch play by Novak Djokovic. One of the best finals he's played. If you look at all these 18 titles, I would put this one, for me, this was even a better performance than the one he had against Rafa at the Australian Open last time in that straight set victory. Here he played superb tennis. I mean, I can pick maybe two or three games at most and take those out, and the rest of it is just first rate tennis by Djokovic and a return festival. How to hit returns 101 to advanced level 400 level, all courses covered. It was a clinic by Novak Djokovic, how to hit great new returns and neutralize your opponent. There were three specific categories I was looking into, but that's tactical talk. I can get into it more if you guys would like me to, but congratulations to Djokovic, hats off, terrific performance.
Mert, we would definitely love you to get more into the tactics. That's why we put you on here on this podcast. So give us some of your foremost tactical insights, the ones that really made the difference for Djokovic.
Okay, on Medvedev, I'll have just one thing to say, but before I get to that, I think let's set the background with Novak. I was personally interested in three specific categories here, how Djokovic would fare against Medvedev, because these three categories were where Daniil was supposed to challenge Novak or even maybe get the upper hand on Novak. One was rallies, just long, hard-hitting rallies with not much variety. In other words, maybe there may be a slice or two still going deep, but this is where both players stay behind the baseline and just duke it out, you know, the back and forth, hard hitting, okay? And with many, many people thought, including myself, I confess, that Medvedev may fare well in these and may even get the upper hand at certain moments. And first set, of course, was going to be crucial in determining who has the upper hand here or set the tone for the rest of the match. They were on equal grounds until 4-4. In other words, there were I counted 8 of these points, and it went 4-4 each way. Now, there are 3 points that I missed in the match for various reasons, and I know exactly where they are, but I didn't have time to go back and look. So maybe I'm missing one shot here or there. But there were 50-50 in these rallies all the way up to 4-4. And then at 4-4, Novak misses a backhand deep to start that game on his serve. Goes down love 15, 4-4, love 15. So Medvedev goes up by one in that type of rally category. From that point on, Novak won 5 of those points until the end of the set to close it out. He closed out that game, won the 5-5 game, 6-5 game, and there were 5 points like that. They all went in Novak's favor, and he ended up winning that category 10-5 because of those 5 matches. What does that tell you? Novak is clutch. Okay, there's no other way to say it. Novak raised his game when needed and won those points. The second category I was looking at is the second shot after the serve. In other words, after a good serve, what does Daniil do with his second shot versus what Novak does with his second shot? In that category, they also went 50-50 for the whole set. But this was more due to Novak missing a couple of, in my opinion, very makeable second shots. Good first serve, weak return by Daniil, forced weak return by Daniil, and Novak just simply missed the short ball and into the net or deep. And Daniil had one of those too. So, you know, they were 50-50 in that category, except that from 5-5 to 7-5, Novak had a 1-2 punch forehand winner at 5-5, 30 love. So he had one more after 5-5, which Daniil did not have. The third category that I focused on was rallies with more than 6 shots cross-court back and forth. In other words, I felt that it was to Medvedev's advantage to engage in these monotonous cross-court, backhand-to-backhand, or forehand-to-forehand rallies where both players do not have to run around too much. There were 3 points like that played the whole first set. Medvedev won all 3. But guess what? Novak didn't let him play more than 3 of those. He relentlessly switched corners. In other words, if Medvedev hit a second shot back cross court, Novak would go down the line, or he'd go to the middle of the court deep, or he'd slice a short ball. He was absolutely not going to engage in that cross court pattern back and forth of 5, 6, 7 shots with Daniil. And if you want to see lively examples of those, watch the 2 games from 4-3 and 4-4 games in the first set. There are about 5 points there during which Daniil tries to bait Novak into, you know, engaging in cross-court rallies, and Novak each time accelerates it down the line or hits it straight to the middle deep or slices it short and refuses to engage in the type of rally that Daniil is comfortable with. And those 3 things, to me, made the biggest difference. Novak won the first set, and I felt at the end of first set, I tried to think of what other options does Medvedev have here, and I couldn't come up with any, and that's largely because Medvedev backpedals from the service line back to the baseline. He's not a guy who's willing to come into the net, and that also made it one-sided after that point.
Sure. So I have a couple of follow-up questions here, and I think you unpack, you know, a lot of statistical nuance where, you know, I'm not prepared to challenge that, but I'll throw in. the observation Darren Cahill made, and I've been thinking along that line when we talk to you. I'll bring this. And you said rightfully that, you know, the longer points, cross-court exchange, Djokovic didn't really allow that kind of play to get established more than a few times. But Cahill said something in the second set when Medvedev got broken three times. He was being impatient on his own service games. He was trying to finish quick fashion points. Maybe that worked in the first set. But in Novak's service games, as good as Novak was serving, Medvedev was still making some inroads. So if you want to unpack that, if you felt the same, and secondly, was it a function of, you know, Djokovic just, you know, rattling Medvedev, that he didn't have a plan B when it came to his own service games? Because there was a clear pattern, he breaks and then he gets broken, I think, three times to lose the set. So if you want to add some context to that, what you saw.
Sure. Okay, as far as Medvedev trying to finish the points too quickly, he tried that a little bit in the third set too. I think he needed to try something else there because his A plan was not working. And, you know, in the first set, you know, those three categories I mentioned, and in these rallies where both were hitting hard from the baseline, but at the same time having to run. So, you know, this grueling baseline rallies went in Novak's favor, especially from 4-4 all to the end of the first set. So when second set begins, you know, Medvedev, in my opinion, starts with very few options. But lo and behold, you know, a chance drops in his lap. Novak has an average game, average serving game, if you consider his standards for the match. He has an average serving game, and he loses his serve. And in that next game, the Love One game, it's 30-all, and Medvedev hits 127 miles per hour, first serve to the tee. And Novak reaches and makes a return deep to the middle of the court, right to Medvedev's feet by the baseline. And he was so caught off guard. I think we all were. That return is stunning. And Medvedev missed the next shot and went down 30-40. And I think those moments like that just take away your oxygen. Okay, if any oxygen that that Medvedev had from going up a break and at 30-all, and plus it hitting a good first serve, thinking momentarily he has 40-30, chance to go up to love, and then that return comes and loses that point and the next point, and now it's back to 1-all. You know, a little bit of desperation sets in. And I think as a continuation of that desperation, Daniil may have thought, you know, I need to just come up with great shots here to win. And then it's not really in the nature of his game. And he loses his serve three times. I would give credit more to Novak than criticize Medvedev there. He was in a helpless situation there mentally, I think.
Sure. So one more question on Medvedev, and then, you know, I'll let Matt have some other questions, and, you know, we'll take turns as we do. So in this regard, I mean, you know, like we can all look back at the 2019 US Open final with Rafael Nadal and say, you know, and everybody believed, you know, you lose that kind of a match, that gives you enough confidence how to behave, how to function in this kind of environment against an all-time great. But again, as we all learned this lesson, what, less than 6 hours ago, that, you know, this was a new situation, and Medvedev, as good as Djokovic was, and I think the occasion also plays a part here, right? Not shortchanging Novak at all. I think his service was just unreal. I'll get to that in my follow-up question. But do you think it's also how invincible Djokovic is in the finals? He owns this, you know, arena. You think that had a role, or it was just X's and O's? Players can block that stuff out once the final is going.
Yeah, I'm going to resist that temptation, Saqib. You know, it may be when the match first began at the very beginning, you know, and then Novak goes up 3-love. But then when Medvedev catches up with that break and equalizes the situation, and they actually have very close games at 3-3 and 4-4, I don't think that's a factor anymore. I think there, Medvedev is in the match. He's dialed in. He's trying to set the tone with his own A plan. And Novak just answers the call every single time. And from 4-4 to 7-5, all those long rallies going Novak's way, it's because Novak just pounded one ball after another deep to the corners and basically sapping Medvedev's ability to keep hitting his deep shots back and frustrating his opponents, which is what he usually does. And, you know, and you lose that first set like that 7-5. And again, I keep going back to the same thing. it's no longer, well, I'm not used to this finals of a major. My opponent is Novak. I think it's that last one. My opponent is Novak. And Novak is playing the way he did. When Novak's playing like this, I'm not sure, you know, whether it's a major final, semifinal, or another tournament final. It's going to be very hard for Medvedev to beat him in this case. I mean, let me ask you guys this, Saqib and Matt. At what point in the match did you believe, you know what, I think that's it, Novak's got this? When did you get that impression?
As soon as you won the first set.
What about you, Saqib?
Okay, I mean, my answer may be lame. First set, I was watching in my bedroom without the volume. So I think it takes a lot of context out. Second set, I switched to the living room with full volume on. And when he broke him twice, I knew it's going to be an uphill battle. I think, you know, Djokovic, we know, like Matt said before, my favorite line, his empire is built on winning important points. He was winning all the important points. He was making the right choices. But I still thought that Medvedev may put up some resistance because in the small time of Daniil Medvedev, his talk has built up that we take him as a fighter. But this was a lesson learned that, you know, Djokovic, when firing on all cylinders, you know, is a tough matchup for anyone. And Medvedev learned that firsthand.
Yeah, I'm somewhere between you guys. I felt that it was over when Medvedev was at one love serving, and that one return at 30 all that Novak hits deep and Medvedev gets totally off guard. I think he's mentally shocked at that moment off that return and going down 30-40. And he loses the next point, loses his service break. And I thought at that point, Medvedev, it was going to take a miracle for Medvedev to win that match. And from that point on, Novak rolled. I don't think Medvedev gave up, or I think he lost his belief late in the second set, early in the third set, but then he fought hard to try to get recover that break back in the third set. I just think that Novak gets hats off here.
Mert, we remember the match at in Cincinnati in 2019 when Medvedev was serving first serves on a number of his second serves. I mean, that was an extra piece of the puzzle, an extra tool in his toolbox to give Djokovic and everyone else he played in Cincinnati at that tournament something to think about. And we've seen Djokovic repel Medvedev decisively here in this Australian Open final. In the future, when they meet again on hard courts, not really clay or grass because Medvedev's weaker on those surfaces, but when he plays Djokovic again in a hard court tournament of consequence, what's the poker chip or what's the extra tactic Medvedev needs to consider to put himself on par with Djokovic? And you've alluded to, you know, the reality that Medvedev is not comfortable at net. So that could be the thing that he needs to really re-examine in his approach. But beyond just suggesting that one idea, what is the extra thing or things Medvedev needs to learn how to bring to the table against Djokovic on hard courts?
I think when Djokovic is playing this type of match, and let's look, there's one thing I think that we need to not run away with. In other words, take it and run away with, is that I'm not sure that Djokovic can put out this type of performance every single time he plays Medvedev. If he did, he would not have been 1-3 in their last four matches coming into this match. Okay. So there are two sides to your question, Matt. I mean, if Djokovic plays at this level, what can Medvedev do? And does Medvedev have already a plan that can work against Djokovic? The former is a complicated question. The latter, he's shown he can do. I mean, he can beat Djokovic playing his A game, okay? But, you know, that it also depends on what level of Novak shows up. A good level obviously can still lose to Medvedev, but the level we saw today, it's going to take something special from Medvedev. And these are the type of matches where Medvedev needs to add that dimension to his game. It's not just volleys that he's not comfortable with. It's the notion of coming into the net, transition game. In other words, doing something with short balls instead of running back, being aggressive. It's a mindset that you have to improve. And when you get that short ball and you move up inside the baseline, up to the service line, and you hit that shot with the intention of coming into the net behind or with the intention of winning, you are much more likely to hit an impactful shot versus when you come up to the shot with your mindset, okay, I'm going to hit this and go back to the baseline. If you
Mert, just to interrupt you briefly, this is what you were talking about in the Serena Osaka match with, and also with Jennifer Brady being better in difficult moments in terms of playing with determination. And we clarified determination, not as intensity, but in terms of having a clear mapped out plan that you trust.
Yes. When you get up to that short ball, you have to, if you're determined to come to the net behind or at least do something, this is my shot in the rally where I'm going to take charge or I'm going to directly win the point. Then if you have your mindset in that type of determination, yes, Matt, you know, just like you said, if you're determined to do that, you decided in advance, you're going to produce a better shot on that particular hit versus when you're going back. Now, I'm watching Daniil, and he's already, I mean, he moves forward, comes to a stop, hits the shot, and I can almost tell half a second in advance that he's planning on going back. If you have that kind of reverse determination in your mind, that short ball you're going to hit is not going to have as much impact because there's not, there's not your aggressive mindset behind that shot. So it's not just that he's not comfortable at the net. He will only become comfortable at the net if he sets his mind or if he includes transition game in his a game plan. It's a mindset that you have to practice. It doesn't mean he has bad technique at the net. His technique might be good, but you have to use it. It's like riding a bike. You can learn, read manuals and know by heart how to ride a bike, but you're going to have to get up on the bike and maybe fall a few times before you can finally keep your balance. It's the same idea. And I think this is a problem Medvedev has to solve in order to break into the top three, top two elite, because this is the second time that it's hurting him. This is the US Open semifinal against Dominic Thiem was even a more blatant example of him refusing to do this and therefore coming up short. So this is the second time on top stage that I feel it showed, it stuck out like a sore thumb that he's not willing to do this. He can win 98% of his other matches. That's not a problem. But for this type of going over the barrier type of challenge, he needs to integrate that into his game.
So Djokovic masterclass it is. So Mert, I know you said it was a return fest. In my humble view, I was very impressed with the Djokovic serving. He didn't get a lot of aces, but I think the depth and the placement in the second serves was huge. The numbers were increasing as the week went on. So where do you rate this serve? And combine this with the wider question as the tour progresses. I also think the serve is done in Djokovic's evolution. I mean, scary. I mean, how much can this guy improve? But I think it's to also battle the physical tennis that Medvedev and the likes of Dominic Thiem play. So unpack it. I think this serve response collectively keeping this match and the longer vision for Camp Djokovic.
Djokovic serve over the decade of 2010s, I would say, and we can include now 2020 and 21, so far at least. Djokovic's evolution on serve is probably the single most striking evolution of a shot in tennis in general, not just Novak's game, but in tennis in general. Go back to 2009, 2010. Djokovic's serve is a liability. I remember him double faulting more than him acing. I remember, pundits on ESPN that we still have on ESPN today ribbing up on him about it. You got to do something about double faulting more than hitting aces. It was a liability. And Djokovic, little by little, year by little, turned it into from a liability to a solid first serve, then a solid second serve, cutting down on double faults, then an eventually a weapon-ish first serve. And now he's got one of the best serves on the men's tour. And then his serve is tremendous. He's winning a ton of points off his serve. You know, he's in the same category as those other players who those few other players who go out and you think, okay, you know, if he gets in his first serves here, he's going to win. Because he places them so well. He places them in the corner, takes off the pace. His second serve now is deeper in the box or has a bigger kick. His serve has become a weapon. But Saqib had still not put it over his returns. And his returns are outrageous. Just a match point. I think match point was a microcosm of the whole match. He hits a forehand lunging return again to Medvedev's toes at the baseline. Medvedev this time barely gets it back, and then he hits the winner. I mean, you cannot summarize that match better than that.
Okay, so I think, you know, with Novak Djokovic, I think sitting at 18, we seldom talk about, you know, the Grand Slam race, but I would talk about his ear. I mean, you know, he had a freakish end at the US Open last year. So now I think the conversation is going to get louder. He's at 18 within two of both Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. So where does this win rank and, you know, how does this fuel his rest of the year? Not that he needs any motivation, but I think what do you see? What do we expect from Djokovic? Like you said, you know, you can't expect him to play at this level, what he did against Daniil Medvedev every day, because, you know, he also has a lot of mileage. But I think like most great players, what does this do to, you know, catalyst his greater career even further? I mean, he's hungry. But where do you rank this in terms of, you know, what we can see for Djokovic in 2021?
It's I think from his perspective, it's just another hoop that he went through to reach his goal. He's made it clear that his goal is to you know, break records in almost every category that he can. And this is just another hoop that he needed to go through, get that 18th. And he's got it. So, from this, I don't think this is any different in terms of reaching towards a goal or going up the steps to the top of where he wants to go, where his target is. I don't think this is any different than his 17th, 16th, or let's put it this way. This is not any different than his previous Australian Open titles, in my opinion. So yeah, it's nice to get that record, the 9th Australian Open title. You know, he's got only Rafa has won more of one major than he has at this point. But I think his eyes are set on, you know, getting the most major titles, and that's what he's striving for. So it's just one of the steps. But I think Matt would probably have a more comprehensive angle on this than I would. You know, Matt, what do you think?
Well, you know, Djokovic. There was reason to think that with Djokovic that after all that happened last fall. You know, two very distinct events, the DQ and then, you know, Rafa rising up in the final. And, you know, remember that French Open final was played under a roof. So a lot of Nadal fans freaked out about it. Uh-oh, it's indoors. So it's, you know, on Novak's turf, really. Or that, like, it's not going to play like a true clay court match. Much as I don't think people were expecting Djokovic to drill Medvedev this easily. I don't think people were expecting Nadal to drill Djokovic the way he did in Paris. I think a lot of people were prepared to think that Nadal could win. I think the expectation from the tennis community going into that match was that it was pretty much a 50-50 call, that it could have gone either way, and that Djokovic had his best chance ever to beat Nadal in a Roland Garros final, but I think it was fairly evenly split. But I think no one was expecting Nadal to run through Djokovic the way he did, and so there was reason to think, and that was amplified by the ATP Finals with Djokovic losing that mini double break lead to Thiem in the tiebreaker. There was reason to think, not to necessarily, you know, guarantee it, but, you know, it was reasonable to think in some quarters that, oh, maybe Djokovic is just losing his mental edge just a little bit, you know, not a lot, but that slight degree, which, you know, has made all the difference in his career. I mean, when we consider Djokovic's career and when we consider the Big Three era, you know, Djokovic compared to Federer swings on 6 points, 2 points in the 2010 US Open semifinals, 2 points in the 2011 US Open semifinals, 2 points at 8-7, 40-15 in the 2019 final. Any of those points are different. We're having a very different conversation about how Djokovic and Federer and how the big three stack up. So Djokovic has made those slight margins work in his favor. And after the fall, US Open, Roland Garros, ATP Finals, it was reasonable to at least put forth the idea that maybe Djokovic had lost that very slight extra 1% that lifted him above the competition again and again and again. So I think what this Australian Open does, not so much the fact that Djokovic won the tournament, but more about how he did it while playing through pain in the middle third of the tournament. And, you know, like a diminished Djokovic was better than a fully physically healthy Zverev. Man, that is an enormous statement of not just I'm better than you are, but like I'm going to continue to be here. Like if I can beat you while I'm in pain, referring to the Zverev match, then I'll be able to beat you when I'm 40 years old. So I really think that this Australian Open, beyond setting up Djokovic's year perfectly, it sets Djokovic up, you know, to be an even better, quote unquote, old man tennis player than Federer's been. I mean, Federer has set an amazing standard for playing at a high level in your late 30s, and, you know, matching, if not exceeding, Ken Rosewall from the 1970s when he made the finals of Wimbledon and the US Open at age 39. I think Djokovic is now in a position to be even better. And if that's the case, you know, we're talking north of 25 major titles for Nole before it's all said and done.
Okay, so I think that's a very comprehensive answer. And I can, you know, give the floor to both of you, like Mert just did, include Matt in that question. So let's talk about Tsitsipas Nadal. Again, this is more from the Tsitsipas lens of things. You know, second time at this major, he's reached the semis. And while doing so, he's beaten, you know, two of the three all-time greats, Federer in, you know, 2019, and now Rafael Nadal from a very unusual position, you know, coming back from two sets to love down. So, Mert, how would you assess that win in the long-term evolution of Tsitsipas? Again, a very young career, a lot of good things to look forward to. How do you rate that win? And, you know, what does the future hold? And, you know, is fitness and going to be an issue that he needs to work on? You know, how he didn't have much left against Daniil Medvedev in the semis.
Yes. Okay. First of all, that quarterfinals, it's not, you know, as what does that win hold for Tsitsipas? I think that type of win was going to come one day anyway. It's to Stefanos' advantage that it came this early. And the way it came, it was shocking. That was a shocking upset. In other words, what I want to say is it's an upset that Tsitsipas defeats Nadal at this point in a major. But it's not a shocking upset. It's possible. But the way it happened, you know, going down two sets and Rafa basically directing traffic, dominating the first two sets, nobody thought at that point that Tsitsipas was going to come back and win. Very few people, I'm sure, thought it. And they must be fanatics of Stefanos still thinking that, okay, he can come back and win. I mean, most people thought that the match was over there. But then Stefanos comes back and wins. That's what makes it a shocking win. And that's going to make Stefanos catapult, you know, upward quicker than he would have otherwise. But at one point, he would have. So this match just, in my opinion, made things faster, you know, sped up his progress towards the top of the game. In terms of what happened in the match, I think it's a combination of both. I felt that in the tiebreaker, Rafa gave Stefanos oxygen. And what I mean by that is Rafa played one of the worst tiebreakers I've seen. And I'm going to give Stefanos credit the rest of the way, by the way. But in this particular case, Rafa misses two overheads. He has two other frame shots that he misses. Very highly unlikely from Rafa to play a tiebreaker like that to close out the match. In fact, I can't remember one where he did. I mean, he missed two overheads in one tiebreaker. And apparently the stats say, I didn't count the unforced errors myself, but the stats say that he had the five unforced errors first set, five unforced errors second set. until the tiebreaker, and he had five more unforced errors just in the tiebreaker, two of them being an overhead. So that's you know, Rafa having a bad tiebreaker. But from that point forward, the way Stefanos stepped inside the baseline, took every ball early, pressured Nadal like crazy during rallies, making him run side to side, and then winning his serves with ease, getting a lot of first serves in, never allowing Rafa to reach 30 once, I think, in two sets, or never allowing him to reach 40, never a break point, not even close. You know, all that put a lot of pressure on Rafa, and I'd like to give Tsitsipas full credit for his play in the fourth and fifth sets. I mean, he believed he played the right game and won, and yes, that will help him a lot in his quest to get to the top. As for your second point, Saqib, I'll stay much shorter on that. Sorry, I went a little too long on this initial one. I'm not sure that I don't buy into the lack of conditioning as the reason for which Stefanos lost to Medvedev. I think it's a completely different game. It's a matchup issue. And, you know, beating Nadal, who has a game completely different than Medvedev from the baseline, it's a big adjustment. And Medvedev in general, anyway, has a game that does not match up very well with Tsitsipas. So that was more of a matchup problem than Tsitsipas not having recovered from that five-setter.
Mert, let me ask you this. You know, Medvedev made the final. Tsitsipas made the semifinals. So obviously, Medvedev gained more points. He went deeper into the tournament. He was playing for the championship. On that level, it's obvious that Medvedev had a better tournament. However, you could flip it around and say that, you know, Tsitsipas beat Nadal from two sets down, and Medvedev does not have nearly the caliber of that kind of win from his fortnight in Melbourne, that, you know, Tsitsipas being able to beat Nadal gives him more encouragement for the rest of 2021 and really for his career. So based on those two points that I've laid out, who had the better tournament, Medvedev or Tsitsipas?
Yes, the way you laid it out, Matt, in my opinion, it's a clear answer. Tsitsipas had the better tournament. In their individual personal progress lines, Tsitsipas covered more ground in this tournament than Medvedev did, for sure. It's a huge step he took in this tournament, reaching the semis, beating a superstar on the way to the semis for the second time in a row. But again, considering, you know, keeping in mind the way he beat Rafa.
Okay, so let me ask you this both. Matt, you can go first. We've talked about this a lot. So does the outcome of this tournament on the men's side, especially the progress made by Tsitsipas and Daniil Medvedev reaching his second final, does this change the power ranking of the challengers who are challenging Nadal and Djokovic? And we'll wait for it till Federer gets back in the mix. Does Medvedev eclipse Dominic Thiem in any way? Because Thiem has had injuries in the last two majors or physical issues. So Matt, you can go first if that order has been reversed yet.
Yeah, one would have to say that Dominic Thiem was not physically fit against Dimitrov, and that takes nothing away from Dimitrov, who played a solid match, did what he had to do in the moment, but nevertheless, Dominic Thiem was not himself. And it wasn't, you know, nerves. It was, I mean, he requested a different pair of shoes late in the first set. So you don't really see that very often. It was certainly physical discomfort was fairly prominent in that match to prevent Thiem from being himself. So I think Thiem is still firmly the best of the non-big three. Precisely because Medvedev did not have an overwhelmingly tough path to the final. I mean, Tsitsipas was his toughest opponent on paper, but coming off a five-setter against Nadal, which we all know, it's the mental bounce back, which is so tough after you play a member of the big three, even more than the physical. It's the mental side. You know, Tsitsipas was simply not in position to play his best match against Medvedev. So, you know, Medvedev did what he was supposed to do by making the final, but like there was nothing spectacular about it. And that's not to diminish what Medvedev did, just to point out that, well, in terms of paths to a major final, this was a comparatively soft one. I mean, he got the right situational breaks to get a fairly smooth road to that final. That's just calling it for what it is. It's not an implied criticism. So Medvedev did not, and I share Mert's view, having asked him that question. Yeah, Medvedev did not really evolve profoundly at this tournament. He merely took advantage of six favorable matchups, whereas Tsitsipas, you know, took a bigger forward step in his evolution. But you know, how did Tsitsipas evolve to the point where he's on team's level? Obviously not. I think that if Tsitsipas had at least extended Medvedev to five sets, maybe we could revisit that question. But you know, teams won a major, been in major finals at multiple majors, so that really is a status unto itself. And team has the upcoming clay season in which to throw down a marker. Also, of course, that brings up the point that Medvedev has not established himself on either clay or grass. So in terms of, you know, a full season, all surfaces, it's still team over Medvedev by a considerable margin. And I think Tsitsipas came much closer to where Medvedev is right now. And then we also have to say, this was a very damaging tournament for Alexander Zverev to not be able to hold those leads in the third and fourth sets against a clearly suffering Djokovic, who had not yet come through the pain-filled part of his tournament. To not be able to beat a diminished Djokovic, who was definitely in trouble, definitely fighting an uphill battle, to not win that match, you know, that could acquire a lot of emotional baggage for Zverev. You know, he had the major final against Team. He served for his first major championship. And so it was easy to think, well, okay, you've now been through the fire. You've been through that particular challenge. So you can use that as a growth point in your career. But then we see this quarterfinal against Djokovic, and that's regression, not evolution. That was supposed to be a moment where Zverev learned from his US Open experience, but instead he regressed. So in many ways, one could say that it's an even bigger story that Zverev went down in the pecking order rather than Tsitsipas went up, because Tsitsipas still has a long ways to go to get to team standard. But I think Zverev fell away from team standard, and he definitely moved downward on the chart relative to how he stands among the non-big three contenders.
Matt, I would completely agree with that. You basically summarized it very well. I have nothing to add, especially your last point with Zverev is right on point. He was ahead of this pack maybe a little bit by a quarter of a step after the US Open, but no more. And the only minor detail that I'd like to add to what you said is I noticed maybe some people may be critical of Team, saying that he's put out, you know, his results have been below the expectations in the last two majors and since the US Open. And it's true. You know, it's true. That's a fair criticism. But before passing any judgment on Team, I would wait until the clay court season and what takes place in the French Open. And then I think it would be fair to maybe pass judgment on where Team is in his career. He won his first major, and there is not the first player to necessarily not live up to the expectations of winning your first major in the few months that follow. So if you're a Team fan and you're wondering about that question, you're worried, I would wait until the clay court season plus the French Open to be over before you can pass any type of cogent judgment.
Sure. Let's wrap, in my view, unless Matt has more questions, the men's draw, and we'll bring in Aslan Karatsev. So what do you guys think of his run? I mean, I talked briefly about him, I think, in one of the first podcasts when he was going to beat Diego Schwartzman. I didn't pick that, but I thought he's going to be someone who's going to play steady, and boy, did he play steady. So what is your take on that, Mert? And Matt, you can go second. I made a comparison, Mert, to you, that his backhand swing rotation is very much like Andy Roddick, at least the beginning of the shot. So fill in with your initial, you know, experience of watching this Russian, and is this a stock buy or sell? Is he going to stay in the top 100?
Yeah, no, I really like his game, but I'll be very honest here. I've seen him play before several times, even before this tournament, but I've only seen him when he's on the rise. In other words, I don't remember his matches from 3, 4, 5 years ago. I don't even remember if I watched him, but if I did, because, you know, you watch matches hundreds of matches over. I mean, I do at least over a period of 3 or 4 years. And sometimes I forget who I watch because I watched a lot. I watch a lot of smaller tournaments too. But the ones that are clear in my mind are from his good performances in the recent past. So, you know, if you were to ask me, if I had no idea about ATP rankings, if I just dropped from sky and I watched this guy play a few times, I'd say, oh, he must be a, you know, top 20 player. I mean, he's got a very flashy game. I actually really enjoy watching Karatsev as a tennis fan, you know, his game. Let's just see how this is going to translate into ATP tour performances, because he's played, you know, lower level tournaments for the most part. Now he's got the ranking to enter, you know, ATP tour events one after another. And let's see how he handles as a guy who is now well known on the tour and who might be even feared, but he has to face a higher level of competition from first round forward from this point on in every tournament for the next, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 months. And I'd like to see how he handles that situation before really forming a complete opinion of his game.
I think the main epiphany or statement to make regarding Karatsev, Sakib, is simply that, you know, we've seen the past several years in men's tennis, these late stage evolutions. And Stan Wawrinka was the guy who started it all in 2014 when his emergence was at age 28 after many years of struggling. We've seen Kevin Anderson get to a couple of major finals very late in his career as well. We've seen John Isner play his best tennis in his early 30s. So many stories of players who really labored in the salt mines without a lot of return on their investment, and they kept at it, they stuck with it, and they found some prosperity. So Karatsev is 27, and he had not won a main draw match at a major, period, entering this Australian Open. And he had won only 3 main tour matches, and only 2 of them in the past 5 years or so. He won one match in 2015, I believe, against Yuzhny in St. Petersburg, and then he won 2 matches last year during the pandemic. And that's it. All the other main draw matches he won were at the challenger level. So, you know, here's a guy who was just in the background of the tennis world. And then at 27, he suddenly finds the ability to string together not only 5 main draw matches at the Australian Open, but through qualifying. So he won 8. He wins 8 matches in a few weeks and gets this enormous paycheck, gets this moment in the sun. So, boy, you know, we continue to see examples in men's tennis of players who toil for 7, 8, 9, 10 years since the moment they turn pro in their late teens or early 20s, and they don't get the reward, they don't get the big moment, they don't get the huge success, but they keep at it, and one day it happens. And that doesn't mean it's guaranteed for anyone, but it does mean that it's possible. And Aslan Karatsev is a testament to what is possible if you keep staying with it.
So if okay with you, Matt, should we switch to the WTA side of the house?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Mike can go first, and then I'm sure Matt has some solid questions as well. So Naomi Osaka, again, Mert, conversation has been loudest about her, you know, even when she won Australia over Kvitova, I think, what, a couple of years ago. I think the tennis podcast and every other voice in the game was talking about multiple, like double-digit majors. And I think it's only going to get louder with her hard court resume. So my humble observation is that the numerous winners we've seen in the last 7 or 8 years, like Kvitova, Muguruza, and Kerber, and even Sloane Stephens, Osaka is the only player outside of Serena Williams that was favored to win a slam, and she's done it a couple of times. So that, to me, you know, is just solidifying the deal. Like, you know, she's legit. So again, compare this fortnight to the one in US Open, and, you know, like, was there any difference how she dominated the field? if you're a very higher level view of her year, because, you know, she's already in every sort of comparison, how far she's going to go, 10 majors, 15 majors. So my question is coming from that background.
Yes, Osaka has great potential, of course. And what I certainly appreciate about Osaka's game is that she takes that. First of all, the side that I appreciate the most is how she raises her game when clutch moments in the match arrive. You know, that 4-all, 30-all point, or 5-4, 30-40 point. He may have been, you know, for example, it may have been a situation where she's struggling with her first serves, but then when that point comes at 5-all, 30-40, she hits an ace. So she's able to brush, you know, what happened aside in the game before, and we saw that in that match where she double faulted, you know, three times in one game and then comes back and wins the next game, hitting three backhand winners. You know, she does stuff like that all the time. You have to be a champion to do that, period. You know, there's no other way to explain that. And what happened here, once again, in this match against Brady in the finals, is Osaka takes away the forehand cross-court rallies. She wins those. She takes away the backhand cross-court rallies. And then she takes away rallies where she has to, you know, cover the backhand and the forehand corners together. And there came a moment in the match when the first set was over and the second set began where Brady had almost very little options left. Either win the point with a big first serve or win the point by hitting it deep down the middle and force Osaka to have to back up and maybe miss. Those are very limited options. You can't beat a champion with just those two options. You need more. And Osaka just doesn't give you that. You know, she's great at negating her opponent's strengths, whether that's, you know, coming up with big shots on important points or whether that's just nuts and bolts of X's and O's in terms of tactics.
So you think Osaka definitely learned a lot from the US Open match, which was, again, match of the year candidate, according to many, when the two squared off at Flushing a few months ago.
Yeah.
So
a couple of things on that, just very quickly. Obviously, she won more comfortably here. There may be a couple of factors in that. One is that perhaps, you know, they keep saying these courts are faster than very fast. In fact, a few players said these courts are very fast. I'm thinking perhaps, you know, Brady has a quite big loop on her forehand, and her forehand is her biggest weapon. So maybe she felt rushed on some forehands and made mistakes. And same with the backhand too. You know, she has a bigger loop. And when she might have had that, you know, 10 split seconds more time to prepare for these shots at the US Open than she did here. And that may have been a difference. You know, that's one thing. But to me, the bigger difference is Brady's inability to, I don't want to say inability because I don't think she does not have this shot, but she doesn't use it. You know, just Brady didn't have the option, or doesn't have the option, at least she doesn't show it, to hit these short, dinky, off-pace slices, keeping the ball low and bringing Osaka forward to hit maybe a stretch one-handed backhand herself and, you know, force her to come to the net. Brady didn't have that option. And when, you know, that was, when you don't have that on top of everything else that Osaka is doing to take away the pattern rallies away from you, then again, you're reduced to just having to hold your serve with big serves and hope that at one point your opponent has a down period or you come through in a tiebreaker. And it's just too much to ask.
Mert, you know, with Naomi Osaka, we see a player who on hard courts is, you know, easily the best in the world. I mean, there's no doubt that Naomi Osaka on hard courts, clear number one. Everyone else is playing for second place. It's kind of like Serena before motherhood, you know, in the 2015-16, early 2017 period. But of course, Osaka off hard courts, it's a very different story. So lots of things to unpack about this point, but let's start with just the idea that, let's say Osaka just continues to collect hard court majors steadily over the next decade and doesn't make big inroads on clay or grass. Not that And I'm not saying that that's how it's going to happen. I'm not even predicting that's how it's going to happen. But just for the sake of discussion, let's say that does happen or something, you know, pretty close to that. Does that, would that in any way detract from what Osaka, you know, is capable of doing in her career? I mean, it gets to the point of how, you know, how concerned should we be? How much mental or intellectual energy should we devote to the idea that, you know, if Osaka doesn't evolve on clay or grass, that it's somehow not good enough or that it's somehow incomplete? If she just continues to build a hard court castle for herself with more and more riches, you know, that's pretty darn good. But how do you feel about that general tension point?
In the scenario that you put forth, and I find that scenario highly unlikely to happen, but in that scenario, and I know you put it forth just as a hypothetical scenario, where, you know, years and years go by and there's this division between her performance on hard courts versus other surfaces, yes, then let's talk about the dent that that may create in her career. But I find it, let me step first of all backwards. I find it very premature to start talking about Osaka somehow missing something on surfaces other than hard courts. Osaka has been at the top of her game. In other words, the level that Osaka is at right now is only a couple of years old. And she's had to play, you know, just one season of grass and clay court tournaments. You tell me another champion who immediately started dominating on all surfaces right away when they come on the scene. I can't think of any. I don't know if you can. I don't.
I can't. But of course, like Monica Seles was good on clay and hard courts. So it's
right. But did she do that in the very first year?
It's conspicuous, not necessarily that so much that there's a split. Well, first year, no. But I mean, like by 91, she was already there on two. Mm-hmm. But the point, but I mean, like the point of differentiation with Osaka is that Osaka, it's only one. So I mean, Monica never really figured out grass, but she became a two surface player fairly early in her evolution. So it's one point of distinction.
Of course, yes. No, I know. I understand why it's being brought up, but yeah, I don't believe there is this distinction. Okay, now moving forward. First of all, I see no reason why Osaka cannot succeed on grass courts. The balls bounce low. It's considered a fast surface naturally, and it's a surface where big servers benefit from the bounce of the ball and from the speed. I see no reason why Osaka cannot perform well on grass courts. If there's one surface that she may struggle a little bit more to adapt to is clay, because she grew up, you know, all her life, she grew up on hard courts. Clay is not a natural surface to her, and there are a lot of players who grow up solely on clay and they're clay court specialists, and it's hard to beat those one after another. So yes, I can understand that on clay court it may take a little bit more time, but I strongly resist, and I'll underline this again, I severely resist the stamp of hard court surface player only for Osaka at this point in her career. Let's see what we say when this year's grass court season is over and when next year's grass court season is over. If she's out this year, she doesn't win a grass court title and she's out in the first week of Wimbledon, and then in 2022 comes around, she doesn't win a grass court title, she's out in the fourth round or quarterfinals of Wimbledon, then let's talk about that. But at this point, I would I really resist the idea of the talking about how Osaka is doing so well on hard courts, and yet compared to that, how disappointing she's been on other surfaces. I'm not there yet. I'm not ready to discuss that as a legitimate discussion point yet, Matt. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's not legitimate for you to bring it up, because it's
absolutely. Hey, Mert. Hey, if you want to shoot me down, you can do that.
No.
You want? No, really? No. That's a that's a part of discussion. If you know, saying you're full of it, that's a legitimate discussion.
That's the last
thing. I don't mind. And I know you're not doing that, but you can if you want to. I'm just saying, I'm going to say on the air in front of our audience listening in, that's fine, because we want every commentator, not just you, anyone who comes on this show, to be able to be fully honest. And so if we really do value full honesty, then Saqib and I need to be prepared to accept any answer. And
you guys and the audience can feel free to say the same to me too. Mert, you're full of it. But but that's how I feel about Osaka. I would like to wait a little bit more.
We wouldn't want anything less than your unfiltered absolute best, Mert.
Okay, thank you guys.
So a similar question again, but more from Jennifer Brady's lens. I know you've been, bullish on her for quite some time. You actually informed me how good she is during the U.S. Open. And what is her overall all-surface resume like, or potential resume like? So fill the listeners in who really may not know all of her exploits. And is she the best American hope of the current lot? I mean, she's a little bit of a late bloomer. So unpack her, according to your knowledge of her.
Yeah, this is a hard the little detail that you asked in there is this is she the most promising of the American pack? Okay, and you're looking at players like Amanda Anisimova, and then there's Sofia Kenin, who's won a major. So it's hard to make that call. But today, at this point, I would call, yes, I would say that Jennifer Brady is half a step ahead of the other Americans in terms of getting to the promised land, so to speak. And I've been bullish on her game for a long time, and I'm a big fan of hers. She's an overachiever, and she's improving by leaps and bounds. She's improved. She's better today than she was, a year ago or even 2 years ago. And I think that her forehand is one of the more spectacular forehands on the women's tour. And she's good athlete, good serve. I think she has to add, a little bit of variety to her game, but she's certainly not afraid to come to the net. She can play an all around game, and I'd like to see her, confirm this these two major showings. In other words, win now a couple of titles, maybe a couple of big titles, and reach again the second week of another major, and then maybe quarterfinals or semifinals of another major, and vie for the title again. I think she can show, because she can show the consistency that would perhaps we have not seen from other WTA players. I think we can comfortably call now Naomi Osaka consistent performer in the majors, but I'm not sure that we can make that call for necessarily the other WTA players. I think it would be nice to have two or three names, a la Simona Halep or Naomi Osaka or Serena Williams, who consistently do well in the majors and show up late in the stages, in terms of name recognition and attracting audiences. And what better way to do that to have a player like Jen Brady, who's a great watch. If you're a tennis fan, she's a great watch. Her game style, her charisma on the court, the excitement that she generates. And she's an American, meaning there's a huge audience that she can pull to the TV from a global perspective. I would love for her to really be a consistent star when it comes to big tournaments and majors.
Mert, how do you think this Australian Open reordered the power structure within the sport? And I mean, obviously Osaka at the top, that's not a reordering. That was an affirmation and a strengthening of what already existed. But, you have Świątek, Halep, Serena, Brady, Azarenka was not feeling well, and she lost to Pegula early on. Svitolina not going nearly as deep as she had hoped. Any particular observations you have on the non-Osaka part of women's tennis, and any movements you perceive in the power structure after Naomi?
Matt, I'm going to take a page out of your book here and say, really nothing about this tournament was normal. The way players got to prepare. Look, we had a player in the finals. She's a huge outlier in this category, but we had a player in the finals who had the who did the 14-day hard quarantine. Yes, she's a huge exception. The others that did the 14-day hard quarantine did not do well. But nonetheless, she was in the final, and the preparation for this tournament was perhaps the most unorthodox preparation for any major that I've ever seen, that I can remember in my lifetime. And I'm not sure how much of this tournament we want to take as part of the timeline of the evolution of what happens in women's tennis. I'd like to wait for the spring season and the summer to go by to see how some of the names that you just mentioned do. You know, I'd like to know how Ashleigh Barty is going to do. This was her, you know, she was first time in action back after 12 months. I'd like to see how Świątek does when the, you know, French Open comes around, followed by Wimbledon, a surface on which she can play very well. You know, I'd like to see where Bianca Andreescu's injury is, or where, how, you know, what her physical shape is. And if she's back to 100%, what can she produce? Will Garbiñe Muguruza keep up her level? And let's not forget, she was 1 point away twice from taking out Osaka. And, you know, where will she continue that top form throughout the year? These are all questions that cannot at this point be answered to come up with a reasonable evaluation of what you're asking. Just it cannot be answered just from the Australian Open that we've just had. I think we need to wait for the spring season to be over and maybe, you know, halfway into the summer before we can start forming opinions on the general trends of which you speak.
Sure. So I'll ask some specific question that I had in mind regarding the other semifinalist, Karolina Muhova. How much of a building block is this performance here? Again, it's not your typical tournament with the, you know, pandemic and the quarantine bubbles they had, but still, I mean, reaching a major semifinal is huge. So talk about her run here in Melbourne.
Yes, as big a fan of Muhova as I am, and I've been a fan for a while, you know, she would need to back this up now, because this is a great show. And may I remind, Muhova had a very tough draw. She didn't come to the semifinals just, you know, with a convenient draw or a draw that opened up. Muhova had to beat very tough players to get to the semis. She had one of the tougher roads to the semis, but she produced, you know, she delivered, in other words. And she got to the semifinals. I thought for the level that she's shown getting to the semifinals, it was a disappointing first set for her standards, but then she played a fantastic second set and then ended up losing to a Jen Brady, who once again, you know, came out on top for, you know, I give credit to Brady more than blame Muhova for that third set. But yes, I would love for Muhova to do well simply because she's one of the few true all-around court players. You know, she'll slice, come to the net, play aggressive, even serve and volley at times. And I just think that, you know, players like that, like her or like Barty or like Świątek, are just a lot of fun to watch. And for women's tennis sake, I hope Karolina Muhova keeps producing on these big stages and reaches the latter stages. And hopefully, I'd love to see her in another semifinal this year, for example, in a major.
Mert, in terms of Serena Jamaica Williams, is it pretty fair to say that her best chance of getting number 24 is going to be at Wimbledon? Because you look at Roland Garros, and you know that's just going to be more of a grind for her as she gets older. And then you have Osaka's hardcourt fortress established in Melbourne and New York. Is it too simplistic to say that Wimbledon is the place where she's most likely to break through, or is that the accurate analysis that we shouldn't try to overthink?
I think considering the timeline where we are right now, you know, the chronologically, that's a fair consideration. You know, the next two majors coming up are the French Open and Wimbledon. And out of those two, Wimbledon is clearly the one where she has more chance to break through. But I thought You know, in this tournament, we saw a version of Serena that can win a major, in my opinion. You know, let's not let the two set loss to Osaka muddy the image or the portrait that Serena painted up to that point. Serena also had a tough draw. She had to play good players to get to the semis, and she played maybe she moved better than I've seen her move in years. She played defense better than I've seen her play in a long time, and she got to the semis playing, quite frankly, one of the better tennises that I've seen her play over the last 8-9 years. And I really believe that she had a good chance against Osaka. I'll confess, before the match, I had Osaka picked to win the tournament, but by the time we got to the semifinals, I was more doubtful than I had been initially about Osaka's chances of winning the tournament, only because of how well Serena was playing. And so I think we saw, you know, she lost to Osaka, who's obviously the player to beat in this major and at the moment on the WTA Tour. But otherwise, the version that we saw of Serena this tournament can win a major. And that could be Wimbledon or that could be the US Open. French Open is less likely, but I think Serena is right up there in terms of winning her next major. Especially if she gets a more convenient draw than she did in this tournament, for example. And yeah, sorry, I added that at the end, but that's all I had to say on that.
Okay, well, the other particular point of intrigue, Jessica Pegula, how much has she changed the conversation surrounding her own career? Because one could say that Pegula has made an advancement similar to what Jen Brady made at the U.S. Open, that Pegula's run could be placed in a similar basket. Now, obviously, Pegula did not play Osaka in the semifinals. She played Brady, but still, she did punch up in her weight class a little bit. Definitely advanced her career, definitely gained more of a sense that she can accomplish, she can achieve at a relatively high level. So I guess, Mert, how would you compare Pegula's run here in Australia to the run Brady made in New York last September? How similar, how different are those runs, and what implications do you think this has for Pegula's future in 2021 and beyond?
With all due respect to Pegula's great run to the quarterfinals, I don't think it's in the caliber of Brady's run back at the U.S. Open. And, and Brady also won a tournament, won a title before the U.S. Open, 2 weeks before the U.S. Open. She won a title, and then she came into the U.S. Open and went all the way to the semifinals. So that was a sustained progress. Whereas Pegula here, she lost in the round of 16 in the Melbourne tournament to Sofia Kenin. And she played, I believe in January, she played a tournament. I can't remember where, but she lost in the first round. She did have a tough draw. She played I think it's Svitolina. I hope I'm not saying the wrong thing here. But she may have lost to Svitolina first round. I hope it is. But she lost first round in that tournament. And then, in Melbourne, she lost to Kenin. I think it was quarterfinal, if I'm not mistaken. And then here, she has a good run and goes up to the quarterfinals. She does beat Svitolina, so she gets the revenge, if that was who she lost to, I'll repeat. But I don't think it's the same caliber of run. And I would wait a little bit more before. Congratulations to Pegula for her own career. It's a huge step. But I wouldn't call it a big intrusion into the evolution at the top of the game for women's tennis for the moment. I would wait a little bit more before I can include her in that equation with the names that we mentioned before.
Okay. On the other side of the Pegula question is the Svitolina question, since Pegula beat Svitolina. In our Australian Open preview show, Mert, you talked to me about how Karolina Pliskova really is not in that top tier of the women's game, and that there are some significant weaknesses that she has to learn how to shore up before we, you know, just enter future majors, assuming that she's a top tier threat. So, you know, with Svitolina bowing out to Pegula, is Svitolina kind of drifting backward into that Pliskova zone where we shouldn't really assume that she's a frontline contender for majors starting the tournament? Or is, would that be an overreaction to what happened in Australia?
No, I find it fair to say what you said, Matt. I would call it more, though, the multiplication of names, of the multiplication of up-and-coming promising players over the last couple of years, reaching that level, rather than Svitolina stepping backwards in her game. It's just at the top of the women's game, there are just so many more potentially dangerous names to beat now. You know, you can have, I mean, just look at the run that we I just talked about, Muhova or Serena's run, or even Osaka herself. You know, look at the players that they've had to beat to get to semifinals, just to the semifinals or finals, before even having to win the final, is tremendous, tremendous competition. And Svitolina now faces that competition, whereas in my opinion, 5 or 6 years ago, she didn't have to. And her game, her own game, has not necessarily, it has not regressed, but it has not necessarily moved forward that much either. She's still that really solid baseliner with good footwork, getting to every ball, you know, trying hard, mental focus at a high level. But, you know, you gave the Pliskova example. This may be one of those cases also where I'm not sure that she has the game to win a major title unless she gets a little bit lucky in the draw in terms of matchups. You know, players that can take her out don't show up on her half or lose early. It's going to be very hard for her to break through in terms of her career, that next step that she needs to take, which I believe is reaching the finals of a major, correct? Has she gotten to the semifinals? I can't remember from the top of my head.
Oh, Svitolina, yeah, she just hasn't made a final yet.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. It's reaching the, so from her career next stepping stone standpoint, it's going to be very tough now for her.
Okay, Mert, wrapping this up, just, you know, you study this sport so well. You provide such great analysis and insight. We've asked about a lot of specific players and specific topics. Let's just go into Coach Mert's notebook. Any stray thoughts, notes, observations, bullet points that, you know, have been left on the cutting room floor that you want to include in this broadcast before we sign off? Like, and it can be at the top of the sport. It can be in the middle. It can relate to the first round. Just anything else about the women's tour, notable players, notable observations that you want to include in this podcast.
Matt, I'd like to see women play for best of five sets at the majors, second week, or the finals at least. I'm tired of watching women's finals, semifinals, sometimes get good and then end after two sets, or finish after 1 hour and 15 minutes, not allowing millions of viewers who might drop in to glance at the match. And instead of giving that, you know, those eyes to drop in and see a 2 hour, 2.5 hour window opportunity, we reduce it to 1 hour, 1 hour 15, 1 hour 30, and in some situations. And if our goal is to get more eyes on the screen watching tennis, that's not the way to go. And I know there are, you know, arguments here and there. We can get into it, you know, on a separate time, because this would be opening up a can of worms. But that's what we need to do. And here's my prediction. A week or 2 weeks from now, first of all, I'm almost certain, I have no stats to back me up on this, but I'm almost certain that more eyes watched Sunday Medvedev Djokovic final, which was a straight set final, mostly dominated by one player, than the 1 hour 16 minute match on Saturday between Osaka and Brady. I'm sure more eyes watched the men's match, okay, because it was longer than 2 hours. So there's a huge number of drop in viewers, and you're taking that, you're reducing that window during which they can drop in and say, oh, it's not bad, let me sit down and watch this a little bit longer. Not everybody is like you, me, and Saqib. Not everyone watches a match from first point to the last point or schedule, makes their schedule around it. A large percentage of the global tennis audience are the casual viewers who tune in to the big matches. And we're taking time away from them to experience high quality women's tennis by keeping this at the best of three. I'm sure you've heard me say this before or tweet about this before, but that's what I'd like to see. And let me get back to what I was saying. I stopped in the middle, and this is my last statement. I'm going to speculate that in 10 days, in 2 weeks, or maybe in as early as in 1 week, there will still be talk about the Djokovic-Medvedev final, but hardly will anybody be talking or mentioning the Osaka-Brady final on Saturday. It's time to bring this best of five drama and attractiveness of the viewing attractiveness to the foreground for the women too.
And it's time to wrap up our podcast. And I just want to reiterate Murtar Tunga. You can follow on Twitter at Murtov's, the letter T desk, Murtov's T desk, his website, Murtov's Tennis Desk. And he also contributes to Tennis with an Accent. Mert, your analysis and also your availability, your willingness to spend so much time with us on these 20-minute bite-sized podcasts and then on this extended review show. Saqib and I cannot thank you enough for the generosity of your time, the generosity of your answers, and the excellence of your insight. We are profoundly grateful to you for everything that you do, not just for Tennis with an Accent, but in the larger tennis community, your Turkish podcasts, and we do hope that our listeners around the world will tune in to get whatever Mert Ertunga has to offer. Thank you so much for everything that you do.
No, thank you. I enjoy spending time with you guys too. That's anytime.